11. In a rudimentary jacket, minus one sleeve, Lujan, who was being renovated, stood in profile before a cheval glass while a bald-headed tailor either chalked his shoulder and back or else jabbed pins into him, which he took with astonishing deftness from his mouth, where they seemed to grow naturally. From all the samples of cloth arranged neatly according to color in an album, Lujan had chosen a dark gray square, and his fiancée spent a long time feeling the corresponding bolt of cloth, which the tailor threw with a hollow thud onto the counter, unwrapped with lightning speed, and pressed against his protruding stomach, as if covering up his nakedness. She found that the material tended to crease easily, whereupon an avalanche of tight rolls of cloth began to cover the counter, and the tailor, wetting his finger on his lower lip, unrolled and unrolled. Finally, a cloth was chosen that was also dark gray, but soft and flexible, and even just a bit shaggy. And now Lujan, distributed about the cheval glass in pieces, in sections, as if for visual instruction. Here we have a plump, clean-shaven face, here is the same face in profile, and here we have something rarely seen by the subject himself, the back of his head, fairly closely cropped, with folds in the neck and slightly protruding ears, pink where the light shines through, looked at himself and at the material, failing to recognize its former smooth, generous, virgin integrity. "I think it needs to be a bit narrower in front," said his fiancée, and the tailor, taking a step backward, slit his eyes at Lujan's figure, purred with the polite trace of a smile that the gentleman was somewhat on the stout side, and then busied himself with some newborn lapels, pulling this and pinning that, while Lujan, in the meantime, with a gesture peculiar to all people in his position, held his arm slightly away from his body, or else bent it at the elbow and looked at his wrist, trying to get accustomed to the sleeve. In passing, the tailor slashed him over the heart with chalk to indicate a small pocket, then pitilessly ripped off the sleeve that had seemed finished and began quickly to remove the pins from Lujan's stomach. Besides a good business suit, they made Lujan a dress suit, and the old-fashioned tuxedo found at the bottom of his trunk was altered by the same tailor. His fiancée did not dare to ask why Lujan had formerly needed a tuxedo and an opera hat, fearing to arouse chess memories, and therefore she never learned about a certain big dinner given in Birmingham, where incidentally, Valentinov... Oh well, good luck to him. The renovation of Lujan's envelope did not stop here. Shirts, ties, and socks appeared, and Lujan accepted all this with carefree interest. From the sanatorium he moved into a small, gaily papered room that had been rented on the second floor of his fiancée's building. And when he moved in, he had exactly the same feeling as in childhood when he had moved from country to town. It was always strange, this settling into town. You went to bed, and everything was so new. In the silence of the night, the wooden pavement would come to life for several seconds of slow clip-clop. The windows were curtained more heavily and more sumptuously than at the manor. In darkness, slightly relieved by the bright line of the incompletely closed door, the objects stopped expectantly, still not fully warmed up, still not having completely renewed their acquaintanceship after the long summer interval. And when you woke up, there was sober gray light outside the windows, and the sun slipped through a milky haze in the sky, looking like the moon. And suddenly, in the distance, a burst of military music. It approached in orange waves, was interrupted by the hurried beat of a drum, and soon everything died down. And in place of the puffed-out sounds of trumpets, there came again the imperturbable clopping of hoofs, and the subdued rattling of a St. Petersburg morning.
"You forget to put out the light in the corridor," said, smiling, his landlady, an elderly German woman. You forget to close your door at night.
And she also complained to his fiancé, saying he was absent-minded, like an old professor.
Are you comfortable, Lucien?
His fiancé kept inquiring. Are you sleeping well, Lucien?
No, I know it's not comfortable, but it will all change soon.
There's no need to put it off any longer,
muttered Lucien, putting his arms around her and interlacing his fingers on her hip.
Sit down, sit down. There's no need to put it off. Let's do it tomorrow, tomorrow. Most lawful matrimony.
Yes, soon, soon, she replied. But it can't be done in a single day. There's still one more establishment. There you and I will hang on the wall for 2 weeks. And in the meantime, your wife will come from Palermo, take a look at the names, and say, impossible, Lucien's mine.
It's mislaid, replied her mother when she inquired about her birth certificate. I put it away and mislaid it. I don't know. I don't know anything.
The document, however, was found pretty quickly. And in any case, it was too late now to warn, to forbid, to think up difficulties. The wedding rolled up with fatal smoothness and could not be stopped as if one were standing on ice, slippery, nothing to catch hold of. She was forced to submit and think up ways of embellishing and displaying her daughter's fiancé so as not to be ashamed before other people. And she had to pluck up the courage to smile at the wedding, to play the role of the satisfied mother, and to praise Lucien's honesty and goodness of heart. She also thought of how much money had gone on Lucien, and how much more was still to go, and she tried to expel a terrifying picture from her imagination. Lucien, disrobed, aflame with simian passion, and her stubbornly submissive, cold, cold daughter. Meanwhile, the frame for this picture was also ready. A not very expensive but decently furnished apartment was rented in the vicinity. On the fifth floor, it is true, but that did not matter. There was an elevator for Lucien's shortness of breath. And in any case, the stairs were not steep, and there was a chair on every landing beneath a stained glass window. From the spacious entrance hall, conventionally enlivened by silhouette drawings in black frames, a door to the left opened into the bedroom, and a door to the right into the study. Farther down the right-hand side of the entrance hall was the door to the drawing room. The adjoining dining room had been made a little longer at the expense of the entrance hall, which at this point neatly turned into a corridor, a transformation chastely concealed by a plush portiere on rings. To the left of the corridor was the bathroom, then the servants' room, and at the end, the kitchen. The future mistress of the apartment liked the disposition of the rooms. Their furniture was less to her taste. In the study stood some brown velvet armchairs, a bookcase crowned with a broad-shouldered, sharp-faced Dante in a bathing cap, and a large, emptyish desk with an unknown past and an unknown future. A rickety lamp on a black spiraled standard, topped with an orange shade, rose beside a small couch, on which someone had forgotten a light-haired teddy bear, and a fat-faced toy dog with broad pink soles and a black spot over one eye. Above the couch hung an imitation Gobelin tapestry depicting some dancing rustics. From the study, if the sliding doors were given a slight push, a through view opened up. The parquet floor of the drawing room and beyond it the dining room with its sideboard reduced by perspective. In the drawing room, a palm gave off a glazed green light, and little rugs were strewn about the floor. Finally came the dining room with the sideboard now grown to its natural size and with plates around the walls. Above the table, a lone, fluffy little toy devil was hanging from the low lamp. There was a bay window, and from there one could see a small public garden with a fountain at the end of the street. Returning to the dining table, she looked through the drawing room into the distant study
at the Gobelin, now in turn reduced, and then went from the dining room into the corridor and passed through the entrance hall into the bedroom. There, pressing close up to one another, stood two flocculent beds. The lamp turned out to be in the Mauritanian style. The curtains over the windows were yellow, promising a deceptive sunlight in the mornings, and a woodcut in the wall space between the windows showed a child prodigy in a nightgown that reached to his heels, playing on an enormous piano, while his father, wearing a gray dressing gown and carrying a candle, stood stock still with the door ajar. Something had to be added and something taken away. A portrait of the landlady's grandfather was removed from the drawing room, and the study was hastily cleared of an oriental-looking small table inlaid with a mother-of-pearl chessboard. The bathroom window, whose lower part was of sparkly blue-frosted glass, turned out to be cracked in its upper transparent part, and a new pane had to be put in. In the kitchen and servants' room, the ceilings were whitewashed anew. A phonograph grew up in the shade of the drawing-room palm tree, but generally speaking, as she inspected and arranged this apartment, rented with a long view but at short notice, as her father joked, she could not throw off the thought that all this was only temporary, that no doubt it would be necessary to take Lucien away from Berlin to amuse him with other countries. Any future is unknown, but sometimes it acquires a particular fogginess, as if some other force had come to the aid of destiny's natural reticence and distributed this resilient fog from which thought rebounds. But how gentle and sweet Lucien was these days! How cozily he sat at the tea-table in his new suit, adorned by a smoke-colored tie, and politely, if not always in the right places, agreed with his interlocutor. His future mother-in-law told her acquaintances that Lucien had decided to abandon chess because it took up too much of his time, but that he did not like to talk about it. And now Oleg Sergeyevich Smirnovsky no longer asked for a game, but disclosed to him with a gleam in his eye the secret machinations of the Masons, and even promised to give him a remarkable pamphlet to read. In the establishments that they visited to inform officials of their intention to enter into matrimony, Lucien conducted himself like a grown-up, carried all the documents himself, reverently and considerately, and lovingly filled in the forms, distinctly tracing out each letter. His handwriting was small, round, and extraordinarily neat, and not a little time was expended in unscrewing his new fountain pen, which he somewhat affectedly shook to one side before beginning to write, and then, when he had thoroughly enjoyed the glide of the gold nib, thrust back into his breast pocket with its gleaming clip outside. And it was with pleasure that he accompanied his fiancée around the stores and waited for the interesting surprise of the apartment, which she had decided not to show him until after the wedding. During the 2 weeks that their names were hung up on view, various wide-awake firms began to send them offers, sometimes to the future groom and sometimes to the future bride. Vehicles for weddings and funerals, with a picture of a carriage harnessed to a pair of galloping horses, dress suits for hire, top hats, furniture, wine, halls to rent, and pharmaceutical appurtenances. Lucien conscientiously examined the illustrated catalogues and stored them in his room, at a loss to know why his fiancée was so scornful of all these interesting offers. There were also offers of another kind. There was what Lucien called a small appart with his future father-in-law, a pleasant conversation in the course of which the latter offered to get him a job in a commercial enterprise. Later on, of course, not immediately, let them live in peace for a few months. "Life, my friend, is so arranged," it was said in this conversation, "that every second costs a man, at the very minimum estimate, 1/432 of a pfennig, and that would be a beggar's life. But you have to support a wife who is used to a certain amount of luxury.
Yes, yes, said Lucian with a beaming smile, trying to disentangle in his mind the complex computation that his interlocutor had just made with such delicate deftness.
For this you need a little more money, the latter continued, and Lucian held his breath in expectation of a new trick. A second will cost you dearer. I repeat, I am prepared at first, the first year, let's say, to give you generous assistance. But with time, look, come see me sometime at the office. I'll show you some interesting things.
Thus, in the most pleasant manner possible, people and things around him tried to adorn the emptiness of Lucian's life. He allowed himself to be lulled, spoiled, and titillated, and with his soul rolled up in a ball, he accepted the caressive life that enveloped him from all sides. The future appeared to him vaguely as a long, silent embrace in a blissful penumbra, through which the diverse playthings of this world of ours would pass by, entering a ray of light and then disappearing again, laughing and swaying as they went. But at unavoidable moments of solitude during his engagement, late at night or early in the morning, there would be a sensation of strange emptiness, as if the colorful jigsaw puzzle done on the tablecloth had proved to contain curiously shaped blank spots. And once he dreamt he saw Turati sitting with his back to him. Turati was deep in thought, leaning on one arm, but from behind his broad back it was impossible to see what it was he was bending over and pondering. Lucian did not want to see what it was afraid to see, but nonetheless he cautiously began to look over the black shoulder, and then he saw that a bowl of soup stood before Turati, and that he was not leaning on his arm but was merely tucking a napkin into his collar. And on the November day which this dream preceded, Lucian was married. Oleg Sergeyevich Smirnovsky and a certain Baltic baron were witnesses when Lucian and his bride were led into a large room and seated at a long cloth-covered table. An official changed his jacket for a worn frock coat and read the marriage sentence. At this, everyone stood up. After which, with a professional smile and a humid handshake, the official paid his respects to the newlyweds, and everything was over. A fat janitor by the door bowed to them in expectation of a tip, and Lucian good-naturedly proffered his hand, which the other received upon his palm, not realizing at first that this was a human hand and not a handout. That same day there was also a church wedding. The last time Lucian had been in church was many years ago, at his mother's funeral. Peering further into the depths of the past, he remembered nocturnal returns on catkin night, holding a candle whose flame darted about in his hands, maddened at being carried out of the warm church into the unknown darkness, and finally died of a heart attack at the corner of the street where a gust of wind bore down from the Neva. There had been confession at the chapel on Pukhdamskaya Street, and footfalls had a special way of resounding in its twilight emptiness, and the chairs moved with the sound of throats being cleared, and the waiting people sat one behind the other, and from time to time a whisper would burst out from the mysteriously curtained corner. And he remembered the nights at Easter. The deacon would read in a sobbing bass voice, and still sobbing would close the enormous gospel with a sweeping gesture. And he remembered how airy and penetrating, so that it evoked a sucking sensation in the epigaster, the Greek word pascha, paschal cake, sounded on an empty stomach when it was pronounced by the emaciated priest. And he remembered how difficult it always was to catch the moment when the smoothly swaying censer was aimed at you,
precisely at you and not at your neighbor, and to bow so that the bow came exactly on the thurible's swing. There was a smell of incense and the hot fall of a drop of wax on the knuckles of one's hand, and the dark honey-hued luster of the icon awaiting one's kiss. Languorous recollections, duskiness, fitful gleams, saporous church air, and pins and needles in the legs. And to all this now was added a veiled bride, and a crown that trembled in the air over his very head, and looked as if it might fall at any minute. He squinted up at it cautiously, and it seemed to him once or twice that the invisible hand of someone holding the crown passed it to another also invisible hand.
"Yes, yes,"
he replied hastily to the priest's question, and wanted to add how nice everything was, and strange, and heart-melting. But he only cleared his throat agitatedly, and rays of light wheeled blurrily in his eyes. And afterwards, when everyone was sitting at the big table, he had the same feeling you get when you come home after matins to the festive table with its gilt-horned ram made of butter, a ham, and a virgin-smooth pyramid of Paschal cottage cheese that you want to start on right away, bypassing the ham and eggs. It was hot and noisy, and lots of people were sitting at table who must have been in church as well. Never mind, never mind, let them stay a while for the time being. Mrs. Lujan looked at her husband, at his curl, at his beautifully tailored dress suit, and at the crooked half-smile with which he greeted the courses. Her mother, liberally powdered and wearing a very low dress that showed, as in the old days, the tight groove between her raised 18th-century breasts, was bearing up heroically and even used the familiar second-person singular tea to her son-in-law, so that at first Lujan did not realize to whom she was speaking. He drank two glasses of champagne in all, and a pleasant drowsiness began to come over him in waves. They went out onto the street. The black, windy night struck him softly on the breast, which was unprotected by his underdeveloped dress waistcoat, and his wife requested him to button up his overcoat. Her father, who had been smiling the whole evening and silently raising his glass in some special way, until it was level with his eyes, a mannerism he had adopted from a certain diplomat who used to say, "Skål," very elegantly, now raised a bunch of door keys, glinting in the lamplight, as a mark of farewell, still smiling with his eyes alone. Her mother, with an ermine wrap on her shoulders, tried not to look at Lujan's back as he climbed into the taxicab. The guests, all a little drunk, took leave of their hosts, and one another, and, laughing discreetly, surrounded the car, which finally moved off, and then someone yelled, "Hurrah!" And a late passer-by, turning to his woman companion, remarked approvingly, "Zimlichki shumiyat, fellow countrymen celebrating." Lujan immediately fell asleep in the cab. Reflected gleams of whitish light unfolded fanwise, bringing his face to life, and the soft shadow made by his nose circled slowly over his cheek and then his lip, and again it was dark until another light went by, stroking Lujan's hand in passing, which appeared to slide into a dark pocket as soon as darkness returned. And then came a series of bright lights, and each one flushed out a shadowy butterfly from behind his white tie. And then his wife carefully adjusted his muffler, since the cold of the November night penetrated even into the closed automobile. He woke up and screwed up his eyes, not realizing immediately where he was, but at that moment the taxi came to a halt, and his wife said softly, "Lujan, we're home." In the elevator, he stood smiling and blinking, somewhat dazed, but not in the least drunk, and looked at the row of buttons, one of which his wife pressed. "Quite a way up," he said, and looked at the elevator ceiling as if expecting to see the summit of their journey. The elevator stopped. said Lujan, and dissolved into quiet laughter. They were met in the entrance hall by the new servant, a plumpish wench who immediately held out her red, disproportionately large hand to them.
"Oh, why did you wait for us?" said his wife.
Speaking rapidly, the maid congratulated them and reverently took Lujan's opera hat. Lujan, with a subtle smile, showed her how it banged flat.
"Amazing!" exclaimed the maid.
"You can go. Go to bed," repeated his wife anxiously. "We'll lock up."
The lights went on in turn in the study, drawing room, and dining room.
"Extends like a telescope," mumbled Lujan sleepily.
He did not look at anything properly. He could not keep his eyes open enough. He was already on his way into the dining room when he noticed he was carrying in his arms a large plush dog with pink soles. He put it on the table, and a fluffy imp hanging from the lamp immediately came down like a spider. The rooms went dark like the sections of a telescope being folded together, and Lujan found himself in the bright corridor.
"Go to bed!"
again shouted his wife to someone who at the far end rustled and bid them good night.
"That's the servant's room," said his wife, "and the bathroom's here to the left."
"Where's the little place?" whispered Lujan.
"In the bathroom. Everything's in the bathroom," she replied,
and Lujan cautiously opened the door. And when he had convinced himself of something, he speedily locked himself in. His wife passed through the hallway into the bedroom and sat down in an armchair, looking at the entrancingly flocculent beds.
"Oh, I'm tired."
She smiled and for a long time watched a big, sluggish fly that circled around the Mauritanian lamp, buzzing hopelessly, and then disappeared.
"This way! This way!" she cried,
hearing Lujan's uncertain, shuffling step in the hallway.
"Bedroom," he said approvingly,
and placing his hands behind his back, he looked about him for a while. She opened the wardrobe where she had put away their things the day before, hesitated, and turned to her husband.
"I'll take a bath," she said.
"All your things are in here."
"Wait a minute,"
said Lujan, and suddenly yawned with his mouth wide open.
"Wait a minute,"
he repeated in a palatal voice, gulping down between syllables the elastic pieces of yawn. But picking up her pajamas and bedroom slippers, she quickly left the room. The water poured from the tap in a thick blue stream and began to fill the white bathtub, steaming tenderly and changing the tone of its murmur as the level rose. Looking at its gushing gleam, she reflected with some anxiety that the limits of her feminine competency were now in sight, and that there was one sphere in which it was not her place to lead. As she immersed herself in the bath, she watched the tiny water bubbles gathering on her skin and on the sinking, porous sponge. Settling down up to the neck, she saw herself through the already slightly soapy water, her body thin and almost transparent. And when a knee came just barely out of the water, this round, glistening pink island was somehow unexpected in its unmistakable corporeality.
"After all, it's none of my affair," she said,
freeing one sparkling arm from the water and pushing the hair back from her forehead. She turned on the hot water again, reveling in the resilient waves of warmth as they passed over her stomach, and finally, causing a small storm in the bathtub, she stepped out and unhurriedly began to dry herself.
"Turkish beauty," she said,
standing only in her silk pajama pants before the slightly sweating mirror.
"Pretty well built, on the whole," she said after a while.
Continuing to look at herself in the mirror, she began slowly to draw on her pajama top.
"A bit full in the hips," she said.
The water in the bath that had been flowing out with a gurgle suddenly squeaked, and all was quiet. The bathtub was now empty, and only the plug hole retained a tiny, soapy whirlpool. Suddenly she realized she was dawdling on purpose, standing in her pajamas before the mirror, and a shiver went through her breast, as when you are leafing through last year's magazine, knowing that in a second, in just a second, the door will open and the dentist will appear on the threshold. Whistling loudly, she walked to the bedroom, and the whistle was immediately cut short. Lucien, covered to the waist by an eiderdown, his starched shirt front undone and bulging, was lying on the bed with his hands tucked under his head and emitting a purring snore. His collar hung on the foot of the bed, his trousers sprawled on the floor, their suspenders spread out, and his dress coat, set crookedly on the shoulders of a hanger, was lying on the couch with one tail tucked underneath it. All this she quietly picked up and put away. Before going to bed, she moved back the window curtain to see if the blind had been lowered. It had not been. In the dark depths of the courtyard, the night wind rocked a shrub, and in the faint light shed from somewhere unknown, something glistened, perhaps a puddle on the stone path that skirted the lawn. And in another place, the shadow of some railings fitfully appeared and disappeared. And suddenly everything went dark, and there was only a black chasm. She thought she would fall asleep as soon as she jumped into bed, but it turned out otherwise. The cooing snore beside her, a strange melancholy, and this dark, unfamiliar room kept her suspended and would not allow her to slip off into sleep. And for some reason, the word match kept floating through her brain. A good match. Find yourself a good match. 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 An unfinished, interrupted match. Such a good game. Give the maestro my anxiety. Anxiety. She could have made a brilliant match, said her mother clearly, floating past in the darkness. Let's drink a toast, whispered a tender voice, and her father's eyes appeared round the edge of a glass, and the foam rose higher, higher, and her new shoes pinched a bit, and it was so hot in the church.